Hello, everyone. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Lifestyle CEO Show. I'm your host, Donna Maria, the original Lifestyle CEO, and have we got a show for you today. You guys know that you are here where we empower you to break all the rules, build your own corporate ladder, and create the life you love. Most of the questions that I have been getting recently from you guys have to do with how to expand your business. Some of you have really great businesses. They're successful where they are, maybe even on the internet or maybe in the community where you live, and you're interested in finding out how you can expand through different business opportunities, maybe licensing and franchising. And there's a lot of information out there about it, but you know what? It's not always geared towards people with small businesses. And so I put my thinking hat on, and I remembered that I have been doing a lot of reading of articles and books authored by an expert in that area, and so I decided to ask him if he would be a guest on our show, and lo and behold, he said yes. Today, I am so excited to welcome to the show Andrew J. Sherman, an attorney. He is a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Dickstein, Shapiro, Morin, and Oshinsky. He's also the founder of Grow Fast, Grow Right, an educational and training company for executives of middle market companies. Mr. Sherman has a resume that is just far too long to read, and I can probably not do it justice, but just to let you guys know what you're in for today and what a treat it's going to be, he has authored 14 books on the legal and strategic aspects of business growth. One of them, which is one of my favorites, is called Franchising and Licensing, Two Ways to Build Your Business. He's been featured in or quoted in dozens of publications, including U.S. News and World Report, Entrepreneur Magazine, Fortune Small Business, and just about every newspaper in every major market in this country. Mr. Sherman, welcome to the show today.
I just hoped you'd keep going for an hour with my bio and we'd be done with it.
Well, you know, I just want everyone to know who we've got on the show and that we've got a real expert here. And I love to, I have experts on the show all the time, and I've been telling people that you would be here to talk about franchising and licensing, and I know that it's a hot topic, intellectual property in particular, which is what I like to kind of start off with, is just asking you, can you describe what is intellectual property and why is it so important to any business of any size?
Wow. And we have, what, 3 hours on the show?
Well, no, we've just got one, and I know we're only going to be able to provide everybody with a snapshot.
I understand. I'm just giving you a hard time.
Okay.
It is probably the number one hottest issue in our Grow Fast, Grow Right seminars. It's the number one hottest issue when I do media appearances like this one. Everyone wants to know, where are our hidden assets, and how do we find those assets? How do we properly categorize those assets into market opportunities, profit opportunities, growth opportunities? And one of the things that I talk about in the seminars is that every business, be they big or small, be they high-tech or low-tech, be they craft and consumer-oriented, or whether they're developing a piece of software, has some intangible hidden asset that not only does the law protect, but that can be turned into a business growth opportunity.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that every business, no matter what it is that you're doing, and I really want to tap into the desire for people who are small business owners who may not have sort of an instinctive feeling about that. If you're selling, I don't know, cosmetics, for example, on a very small scale, and a lot of the listeners to this show just happen to be in that industry, and, you know, it's natural to think that your sugar scrub is the best asset you have, and what you're saying is that there are hidden assets you need to be concerned about, and I want you to tell us what they are.
Well, there's a wide range of them. It could be your customer base. It could be your brand. It could be some system. It could be that you've discovered a great outsourced manufacturing technique that could be applied to other companies that do similar non-competitive things. So many times people treat these intellectual property assets as if they can't share with others because it gives them a competitive edge. But what if the company that you're sharing with or licensing to doesn't compete with you?
Right.
And I can give you examples from the Fortune 500 of things that apply there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk maybe, can we divide intellectual property up? I know there's a lot of different categories, but for purposes of the time that we have today, can we talk about copyrights, trademarks, and patents, maybe even in that order?
As long as you include trade secrets in the list, the answer
okay. is okay, well, that's wonderful. I appreciate that additional one. Which order do you think it makes best to talk about them in? And the reason I suggested copyrights and trademarks first is because that's what I happen to know that most of the people that are listening to the show would be most concerned about.
Right. I mean, why don't we talk about patents and copyrights together? Because I bet most of your listeners, and I bet even you, not to put you on the spot, don't know where patents and copyrights come from.
Well, let's start there. That'd be perfect.
So, just to take a wild guess, what set of laws do you think created the patent and copyright laws in this country?
Well,
I'm putting you on the spot, I know, and I apologize to all of your listeners.
Well, there are federal statutory laws that provide the means for protecting copyright material and patented inventions and things like that.
Right, and with the modern world that we're living in and all the technology, when do you suspect those laws were passed?
Oh, far too long ago to be extremely relevant today.
I'm sorry?
Far too long ago to be extremely relevant today.
Well, that's an interesting answer. I think one of the U.S. history observations that your listeners are going to learn today are that the patent and copyright laws actually come from the U.S. Constitution, mm-hmm. Article 1, Section 8. And the reason I share that is not to sound overly lawyerly, but because many entrepreneurs don't realize that these intellectual property laws that we're talking about have in their roots our Constitution. I mean, you think about all the things that the Founding Fathers had to deal with in the 1700s when writing a Constitution for the country. Why did they make Section 8 of Article 1, intellectual property laws, why was that included in among the 8 most important things that they needed to deal with this country?
And that's such a great point because it highlights that it is much more intrinsic to business than a lot of people who are just starting out in business would think.
Exactly. The point I'm trying to make for the listeners, and I'm trying to, you know, get them really focused on just how critical this is that these intellectual property laws have been around since the beginning of our country. We are the only country on the planet that I'm aware of that has intellectual property laws written into its constitution. So when you and I spend some time this afternoon talking about the role and importance of intellectual property laws as a business growth driver, understand that these laws have been around since the beginning of our country. And they've always been designed to bring innovation to the forefront, to foster entrepreneurs to invent and create, and to be rewarded for inventing and creating.
So entrepreneurs and business owners from all walks of life, very large, very small, all have a constitutional right to this kind of intellectual property.
Absolutely. And that it's the very foundation of our country in some cases. And so you're entering into an area of the law that's been around for as long as our laws have been around, and from a policy perspective, has always been there to reward innovation and entrepreneurship, always.
And so have you noticed that it has taken on a whole new type of significance over the past 10 or 20 years?
It has, because what's happened is, imagine that, you every night went to sleep with, $100,000 string of pearls under your pillow, and you didn't know it until you finally lifted up the pillow and realized you'd been sleeping on it.
Oh.
For all that time, it's that hidden asset, the thing that you've always had under your pillow, but you've never really realized that you had and you never utilized. And that's what I'm saying. We as a country have been sort of sleeping with these jewels under our heads for, 200 plus years, and only in the last 10 to 20 years does it seem that entrepreneurs have embraced the protections that they have available to them.
So since every business has it, how do you go about identifying it? And then secondly, how do you exploit it or leverage it to your benefit?
That's a great, great, great question. And so the first thing you have to do is listen into a show like this and learn the basics. learn what these intellectual property laws are for, what categories do they fall into. I mean, the patent laws are different than the trademark laws, are different than the copyright laws. So which categories of information does the intellectual property that you have fall into? Mm-hmm. And that's important because that goes to the point of how do you best work with your lawyer to protect these intellectual property laws? Because before we can go about leveraging them into market opportunities, we, of course, have to understand how these laws are protected,
mm-hmm.
these assets are protected.
Okay.
And so that we can get into in the next segment. Are there, do we just keep going, or are there breaks, or I'm just trying to gauge how much we cover in a given moment?
Yes, we are going to take a break, and I'm so glad, Andrew, that you sort of took me back to the Constitution, because that highlights, the fact that this is not a new issue, and it also really underscores that as American citizens or people doing business in America, we do have access to an asset that we may not otherwise think we have. We are going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more specifically about copyrights, patents, and trademarks, and how you can find yours or develop yours and then leverage it to your benefit. This is the Lifestyle CEO Show. We'll be right back.
Why is everyone listening to GlobalTalkRadio.com? Because it's the future of talk radio. Every day, more and more people are finding internet radio as not just an alternative media, but as a replacement to traditional AM and FM broadcast stations. Internet radio offers a wider variety of programs, convenient on-demand listening that meets your schedule, and fewer commercial interruptions. And GlobalTalkRadio.com is already leading the way by matching this content with a highly targeted internet audience. GlobalTalkRadio.com offers its listeners one of the widest programming varieties on the internet, from business and finance to self-improvement, paranormal, health, literature, romance, politics, and more. There are also opportunities for prospective hosts who would like to host their own weekly or one-time talk shows. Want to learn more? Check us out at www.globaltalkradio.com and see the future of talk radio today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Lifestyle CEO Show. We have a lot of ground to cover today. We're here with Andrew Sherman, renowned intellectual property attorney, and when we took our first break, we were talking about the different kinds of intellectual property and how many of them have their roots in the United States Constitution. We're going to start this segment by talking about a particular type of intellectual property that I know is of concern to many listeners out there, and that is a trademark. And by the way, we're going to open up the phone lines in a minute. The number to call your question or comment in to Andrew is 800-773-0355. Andrew, can you start off by just giving a basic definition of trademark and why it is so important and what people can do to find it and protect it?
Yeah, now let me give you some historical context again, just very quickly, and that is that unlike our big brothers and sisters, patents and copyrights, the trademark laws have only been around since the 1940s. So trademarks were not built into the U.S. Constitution, and they have a very, very different history. And I say that because there's again, one more, you're going to think I'm some legal historian, and I certainly don't mean to be, but got an hour to work with. But there's one other very interesting point about trademark law, and that is when the trademark laws were first passed in the 40s, the courts never viewed them as being an asset to businesses. Now, we find that strange today because, of course, companies have brands that are worth billions of dollars, like the Windows brand from Microsoft or Pepsi or Coca-Cola.
Mm-hmm.
Early days, the trademark laws were a subset of consumer protection laws. And so if you were using a given product and you were injured by it, the trademark laws were only there to identify who you then sue for your injury. And it was only in the 1970s and 80s that the courts and the Supreme Court started recognizing that, wait a second, these assets have a tremendous value above and beyond consumer protection. And that's been the kind of thing that has really spurred everybody's interest in brands and branding and slogans and colors and designs and everything else that are indicia of where a particular product or service comes from. And I know for many of your listeners, establishing a right brand, building that brand, protecting that brand through trademark laws, protecting it globally are all of interest. So I'm sure you've got a bunch of questions around that one statement.
Yeah, and so while the trademark laws do still protect consumers, correct, they just also do far more than that.
That's right. But really, the law has really shifted much more into looking at brands and brand identity and slogans and other things mm-hmm. as a very important strategic asset of business. Mm-hmm. But I was trying to compare it to, say, patents and copyrights. It has not always been that case.
So let's say I'm a person who is considering strongly starting a business, and I am thinking about different names that I might like to give my business. If trademark law can protect or not protect the name that I choose, what sorts of things do I consider when choosing a name?
Okay, great question. Let me lay out, as long as I don't put anybody to sleep on the show, the sort of layers of trademark protection under federal law.
Okay. Now, to the contrary, I'm going to encourage my listeners to get out a pen and paper.
Well, I would encourage that, too, because this is not only a great radio show, and you're blessed to have Donna Maria as your host, but it's also free legal advice, which is very valuable.
Hello.
What's that?
I said, hello, everyone. That's
exactly. Free. Did we say free legal advice?
We sure did.
So if we start at the top of the ladder, you have what's called arbitrary or fanciful. Now, arbitrary or fanciful are made-up words. They're words that have nothing to do with the underlying product. So like Camel for cigarettes is an example of a completely arbitrary connection between the thing and the underlying product or the brand and the underlying product. Now, those are, of course, the strongest under the law, but you marketing people listening, you're probably saying, forget that arbitrary or fanciful stuff because those are the hardest things for me to build brand around. Mm-hmm. How can I possibly convince my consumer that a desert animal has anything to do with a brand of cigarettes unless, of course, I've got a couple $1 billion in advertising?
Right.
Then you get to the next level. Now, this is where it's really worth writing down and double-circling it with your pen. That's called suggestive. Now, suggestive is an equally strong category of trademark under the law, but that's where the brand somehow suggests but doesn't state, and that's the key words here, guys, suggests but doesn't state the underlying product. So let's look at an example there. Orange Crush for soda, Mountain Dew, Dove for soap. These are all product names that sort of suggest something about the underlying product, you know, the dew of a mountain and it being refreshing and pure and clean, and I'm not endorsing any particular soda brands here.
Right.
The point being that there's a suggestiveness, but without it being completely arbitrary.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see the difference?
Yes, I do.
Now, the worst kind of trademark from the law's perspective, even though, of course, it's everybody's favorite from a marketing perspective, is the third tier on the ladder, and that's called descriptive marks.
Okay.
So something like Pizza Hut, Holiday Inn, these are suggestive in the eyes of the law.
Mm-hmm.
And descriptive in the eyes of the law. And if it's descriptive, and this is as technical as I'll get on this, but it's a very, very important point, so I want to make sure the listeners are clear. If it is descriptive, then you're going to have to prove a concept called secondary meaning. And you don't get to keep the brand for yourself if the mark is descriptive until you've convinced the trademark office, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, USPTO.gov, that you have established secondary meaning. So when I say words like Bank of America, that's pretty descriptive.
Mm-hmm.
But when I say Bank of America, I doubt that you, Donna Maria, or any of your listeners are thinking of different banks. You're probably thinking of one bank called Bank of America. So they've established secondary meaning in their brand, even though their brand itself is descriptive.
Mm-hmm.
That making sense?
Absolutely. So the descriptive I mean, do you have to have just as much money maybe to get your descriptive trademark as you do to get your arbitrary one?
Well, again, it's a difference between allocating as between legal dollars and marketing dollars. So if I do something that's suggestive, it's going to be more efficient for me to protect it legally because I'm not giving a big burden to my lawyers, but it's also going to create some marketing burden on me to get things right from a from the perspective of building brand recognition and clarity in the mind of my target consumer.
So if I were to choose, if that hypothetical person in the beginning of the question were to choose between these three, the ones that would give them the least legal trouble would be the arbitrary and then the suggestive.
Right, but the arbitrary is a real tough battle for the marketing to convince the consumer of the connection between the brand and the underlying product. So if I'm making a line of very elegant handmade soaps that I'm going to distribute all over the world,
mm-hmm.
and I call that the carburetor,
mm-hmm.
oh, I mean, that's pretty arbitrary. So, yeah, you probably will get to own the carburetor brand within a line of handmade soaps.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to convince my consumers that there's some connection between a carburetor and my beautiful handcrafted soaps.
So one of the things you have to have is the patience and the time within the context of whatever your plan is to grow that arbitrary brand into something that your target audience understands.
Exactly. And a good example of that would be Starbucks,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, before Starbucks came east, if I had said that word to you, you'd be looking at me like with your head turned funny.
Exactly.
You know, what are you even talking about? Right? Are you talking about money paid to Hollywood stars? I mean, what are we talking about? Now, it's universally known as a brand of leading premium coffee.
Mm-hmm. So, if I am interested in sort of getting rid of the legal issue, I'll go the arbitrary or the suggestive route. And once I decide, let's say I pick three or four names that I think are acceptable to me, I like them, what do I do next? Do I check to see on the internet if anybody else is using them? What's my next step?
Great question. Again, so the next step, once you feel comfortable with your branding, your next step is to do a trademark search to see who may own that brand, either within your category of ownership or in, you know, sort of competing categories of ownership. So let me give an example. Or non-related, when the Toyota first rolled out its line of luxury automobiles and called it Lexus, L-E-X-U-S, Mead Data, which owned the LexisNexis legal research database, sued them and tried to stop them from using the Lexus name. Even though the one letter was different, it certainly was very close. And the court ultimately ruled in favor of Toyota because we now have a Lexus line of automobiles. But what they said was no consumer of legal research services is likely to believe that this database company has suddenly gotten into the luxury automobile line.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what if, on the other hand, I had created a series of legal books called Lexus? That might be a more logical extension for a database and research company, and that I probably couldn't use. So my advice for the listeners mm-hmm. is not only to do a trademark search to see who's out there, but do a trademark search in the context of who might be bothered by your use of the name, even if they're in a non-related industry, and are you ready to do battle with them if they come after you?
And you go to do that trademark search on the trademark office database at uspto.gov?
That's right. You can do it there for almost no charge. You may need a little bit of legal help interpreting the results of the search because
mm-hmm.
sometimes what you get is a little bit confusing, but you can mm-hmm. certainly do a quick search online, and there's no charge for that. It's available to the public, and it's something I would highly recommend. But if you're not clear on what it is you're actually reading, then I would sit down with counsel and get some help.
And what about, I know states have different trademark laws. How does that figure in?
Well, that's an interesting question. The state trademark laws used to be a lot more prominent than they are now, but some amendments were made to the federal law years ago that made some of the state trademark laws less relevant. But you can still file for a state trademark if you're a small company that's only doing business in the state. I know that many of your listeners, they may be small companies, but they're doing business all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
So they're really, you know, just to file for a state trademark, unless they're really just doing local craft shows or something, probably doesn't make sense. They're probably better off going for the federal level. And we haven't even talked about, of course, the global trademark issue.
Right, right. I want to talk about that when we come back. We're not quite ready for our first break, though. We'll talk about that when we come back. But I wanted to ask another question about, once you go on the trademark office database, are there instances sometimes where people might be using the name that you want to use, but they don't have a trademark or they haven't applied for one, so it wouldn't show up? So does that make a difference?
Yeah, now you're on to a really good point, and that is when you do the trademark search, all you're getting there is what's been federally registered or applied for or abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
Getting what's called a more comprehensive common law search. And common law rights vest in trademarks as well. So if I own four pizza stores called Andrew's Pizza in Northern Virginia, and they're very, very popular stores, but they're only known in Northern Virginia, I have built up some common law rights in Andrew's Pizza, even if I never register the mark at the federal level. Now, what that does is, while I can't claim to have national brand recognition, if a chain out of Seattle, Washington comes along called Andrew's Pizza, and they arrive in Northern Virginia, and this is a very complex issue, I am actually known as the senior common law user or owner of Andrew's Pizza, but only for as far of a territory as I have customers.
Right, so we can see there's a whole lot of levels here. We're going to explore that in just a little bit when we come back and talk briefly about the global aspects of what we have to be concerned about here, then move on to some of the other intellectual property. This is the Lifestyle CEO Show. I'm your host, Donna Maria, and we'll be right back.
Want to stay on top of what's new in the radio industry? Sign up for a free subscription to the Future of Talk Radio, available exclusively to listeners of globaltalkradio.com, and find out what's new in the world of online radio. Listeners can find out about new shows and special guests. People with something special to offer can find out how to become a guest and how to prepare for an interview. And prospective hosts will find a valuable resource for everything from planning their new program to selecting topics and guests, recouping expenses by selling advertising, and more. Sign up today for your free subscription to the Future of Talk Radio by visiting www.globaltalkradio.com and learn about the future of talk radio today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Lifestyle CEO Show. We are talking today with renowned intellectual property attorney Andrew J. Sherman, and he's been sharing a boatload of helpful information to help anyone out there who is either struggling with an issue related to the intellectual property, trademarks, copyrights of their business, or trying to avoid such a struggle in the future. One of the things we talked about in the last segment was going to the trademark office database and seeing if somebody else might have filed a trademark application for the name that you want to use for your business, or maybe even the brand name for your products. And we talked really quickly about companies that may be using a name, but they haven't filed for a trademark, and so they may not show up on that database. And Andrew, can you pick up where we left off there and say how can someone avoid the issue if the person who later becomes a problem didn't file a trademark application? I mean, it's almost like, gee, what's the point if there could always be somebody out there to come out of the woodwork down the road?
Yeah, it's, you have what's called constructive notice from the day you file on forward. So let's go back, as we did before the break, to Andrew's Pizza. The Seattle, Washington chain, as they come into Northern Virginia, they're going to have to deal with me as the local entrepreneur who has common law rights to Andrew's Pizza.
I see.
And, you know, we'll work something out. I'm sure we'll get a license or we'll get a settlement or they'll buy my rights in this area. But here's the key answer to your question. If a company in Phoenix, Arizona sees that Andrew's Pizza from Seattle is doing very, very well and starts trying to use the brand after the mark's been registered, then Andrew's Pizza in Seattle can shut them down immediately. So the only exception to the tremendous benefits of having federally registered trademarks is that you have to yield to the rights of what's possibly a local, more senior common law owner of the brand. And it goes back to your question from a few minutes ago about, well, how comprehensive of a search should I do, and how comprehensive, how much will I learn if I do a search on the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office website? You'll only learn what's been filed with the Trademark Office. To do a common law search is much more expensive because, of course, they search the yellow pages and databases of on a national basis.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're really, you know, looking to build a multi-million-dollar business, which I know many of your listeners are trying to do,
mm-hmm.
putting a lot of time and effort into your brand, then it may be worth doing that comprehensive of a search.
Right, right. And it could also turn out if you could spend a significant amount of money and then somebody else could come along and challenge you. And that would, you want to try and avoid that. And that kind of goes back to the arbitrary name, where the more arbitrary it is, I'm guessing, the less likely it is that somebody is going to come along. I mean, I'm thinking of names like, just because I'm here on the East Coast, Verizon, the telephone company. I mean, that name had, I'm assuming, no meaning before they started to use it. Of course, they have millions of dollars to make me remember it right off the bat.
That's right. But, and here's another key point, if I'm trying to launch my own new telephone services company and I'm going to try and play off that brand by calling it Horizon or Telrizon or something along the lines of that, you better be ready for a cease and desist letter from the Verizon legal department or their outside counsel. I know many of your listeners have companies that are doing different types of consumer products, and you really want to choose a brand that's truly yours and isn't piggybacking or playing off somebody else's consumer product brands,
mm-hmm.
particularly those that are in beauty care or home products and other product lines along those lines.
Yeah, I guess you could be spending 5 years down the road too much time on the phone with someone like you rather than growing your brand.
Which certainly ensures that my kids go to college, but probably isn't the best way for you to build your business.
For you to build a business, that's right. Well, you mentioned a little bit ago about how global trademark issues fit in here. Can you talk about that just briefly before we move on to copyrights?
It's a relatively complex, but let's see if we can summarize it down to some bite-sized chunks. Trademark laws around the globe are based in use. So maybe I can bring my story out with a funny story of something I did many years ago as a young attorney. I was invited to give a speech in Brazil, and as a young attorney, I went down to Sao Paulo. We were doing legal work for a restaurant chain called Clyde's, which any of you listeners in the Washington area know that chain. Well, I see across the street from my hotel a Clyde's restaurant. Same logo, same style of lettering, same everything. And I get all excited to go introduce myself to my client, and I didn't know they had a restaurant in Sao Paulo.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I walk in blazing with my legal cards, saying hello to everybody, and they thought I was there to sue them because they were not the same company as Clyde's. Copied all of the Clyde's trade dress and brands and systems and menu design because Clyde's didn't do business in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
They were okay to do that because trademark laws globally are based on use. Well, if you've not made use in another country and you've not attempted to protect it, then everybody else is free to use it. So even though it's a very, you know, it can be an expensive thing to pursue, if you're going to be doing a lot of business in other countries, then it's really critical that you take the time to protect it. Now, some of these countries you can file on a regional basis, like the European Union now has a filing. You do one filing and you pick up 14 countries. So those types of filings can be very beneficial and much more cost-effective.
Mm-hmm. So this points out the importance of sort of doing some brainstorming and planning in advance of how big you want your business to grow. Do you want it to be just nationwide, or are you going to explore other countries, in which case you have to be on the lookout for issues like this?
Yeah, and how much time do you want to invest into protecting your brands globally if you're going to be doing business globally? And that's the mm-hmm. dilemma that many small companies have, is they are, in fact, doing business all over the world,
right,
but haven't taken the time to protect their intellectual property all over the world and may find themselves running into some very unpleasant surprises.
Yeah, well, a lot of times what happens with the companies that I talk with and the people that are listening to the show is they get an international opportunity quite out of the blue. They haven't thought about it, haven't really planned on it, but an opportunity comes along that may be quite lucrative if things work out. And, you know, this is an issue that, you know, people don't always think about in advance. So it's something that you guys out there can remember to sort of put on your radar screen. Let's talk for just a second about copyrights, although I know we can't talk for just a second about any of this, Andrew. I appreciate that. But, you know, if we could narrow it down, I get a lot of frustrated emails from people who have their copywritten material stolen off of their websites to market other people's competing products. And I remember one day I received an email myself from someone who told me that someone had taken an entire website of mine, put it up for sale on eBay.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the other thing that we haven't really talked about, and that is the advent of the Internet has made the protection of intellectual property that much more challenging. I mean, you know, we haven't talked too much about copyrights yet, but all of the controversy around Napster and downloading of movies and music, I mean, these are all at their core intellectual property issues.
Right.
And the problem is nobody feels much sympathy, you know, for a hip-hop artist that's worth $500 million in his empire, but if all of his music is downloaded on the web for nothing, then eventually that's going to cut deeply into their revenue streams, into the rights of encouraging other people to be musicians down the road, and then the whole policy purpose of rewarding people for their intellectual capital going all the way back to the U.S. Constitution has been defeated. So that was why the issue became so heated with downloading of music and movies, because we're, in essence, disrespecting the copyrights of these artists, who, yes, they are doing much better than most of us financially, but it's the deterrent effect on future artists if they don't think they'll be able to protect their music or movies.
Right, right. So we've got the copyright-related issue, and I want to ask you, we're going to have to take one more break. I wanted to just kind of maybe try and synthesize a little bit the issue by just asking you, when we come back, if you can tell us what are maybe just one or two things, if we have a website, that we can do to insulate it. I don't mean technical things like, you know, making it so people can't right-click it or whatever, but is there anything from a legal perspective that we can do to protect against somebody misappropriating it without our ability to then get them to stop, using some kind of statute or law to get them to stop? This is the Lifestyle CEO Show. We'll be right back, and our phone lines are open at 800-773-0355. We'll be right back.
You're listening to GlobalTalkRadio.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the final segment of today's Lifestyle CEO Show. Before we took our break, Andrew was sharing some information with us about our trademarks, and we talked a little bit, too, about copyrights. And right now, I want to ask him to just share one or two things that we can do if we have an online business to protect some of our original works of authorship or copywritten material on our websites. Can you help us there, Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of issues. I mean, one, to make sure that if you are using certain names of products and services or brand, that they're clearly marked. So use the TM when the trademark is pending. Use the encircled R when the trademark's been registered. Some people commit trademark infringement and take things from your website innocently, and some people do it, of course, with malice. The ones that are doing it innocently may not realize that, you know, a particular name or design has been trademarked or copyrighted. And so if you're going to claim these rights, make sure you claim them clearly.
Mm-hmm. And similar to going to the trademark office to file the trademark application, is there something you can do to file the, like a copyright application or something?
Yeah, copyright applications can be secured relatively inexpensively by filing at the Library of Congress. I think the filing fee is now up to $20.
Okay.
It's a bargain.
You can copyright your website or your brochure or your catalog.
Yeah, there's the text inside, the designs, all of those could be subject to copyright laws.
And then if you find that somebody's using them without your permission, you can use those laws. If you've made your filing and have your registered copyright, you can use those laws to get people to stop infringing. Is that how it works?
That's right. And the penalties include public beatings and beheadings.
Okay, good. Well, sign us up for that. Hopefully we won't have to deal with that. So let's talk then for a second, if we can, now that we sort of know what the intellectual property that we have is, or how we can establish it and give it some kind of legal protection, can we talk a little bit about another area of expertise of yours that's related, and that's the area of licensing and franchising? Are those two ways that you can, business models that you can choose to expand your intellectual property and make it more profitable?
Yeah, these are exactly that. Once you've identified your intellectual property, as we've been talking about, once you've taken the time to protect it, you don't just let it sit on the shelf. You take
right.
these intangible assets and you begin working to try and find ways to turn these assets into income, to mm-hmm. penetrate new market opportunities, to do things that big businesses do with their intellectual property. IBM earned last year $2.5 billion, that's billion with a B, revenue in just from licensing alone. And so you want to take the page out of the big company playbook and learn from the IBMs, learn from McDonald's. I mean, you look at McDonald's with their 30,000 locations around the world. What is McDonald's? It's a trademark of brands. It's a license of trademarks and brands and operating systems and trade secrets. That's all it is. It's a license of intellectual property. All of the franchise systems around the world are essentially good, solid entrepreneurs packaging up their intellectual property, and sometimes there's not even any patents involved. It's just copyrights, trademarks, and
right.
trade secrets, and
right.
then licensing them to entrepreneurs who would rather go into business with that head start and with access to the intellectual capital than trying
right.
to figure it out for themselves.
Right, they don't have to make up anything from scratch. So let's say I'm a massage therapist in Washington, D.C., and I travel around to law firms or other office places to provide, you know, busy and exhausted executives with, you know, the 15-minute seated massage. And the name of my business is Donna's Massage Therapy. Let's just make it easy. And I noticed that, you know, my colleagues in other areas of the country are doing that for their offices, for executives in their part of the country, in their area. Can I then use franchising or licensing to expand Donna's Massage Therapy into other cities?
Absolutely. We'll probably want to go with a brand, you know, that's not quite as descriptive as Donna's Massage Therapy, but if
okay.
you packaged up the format, if you have some competitive edge, if you have some things that you've developed that would be of interest to a licensee,
mm-hmm.
you absolutely could begin franchising. Now, maybe in a future show we'll talk more about what it takes
mm-hmm.
to do that franchise, but in a nutshell, you need to develop a set of disclosure documents under federal and state law that are designed to teach the franchisee everything there is to know about the business,
mm-hmm.
Make full disclosure of the fee structure and what their obligations are going to be and that type of thing. But then you're off to the races, and you could be the next McDonald's. You could be the next big established franchisor.
Right. Now, what if I don't want to have such a franchise? What if I is licensing something that's similar to a franchise but maybe doesn't have all the extra paperwork? Is that another option for me?
Yes. Now, if you're going to license a full-blown business format, mm-hmm. the law is going to consider that a franchise no matter what you call it.
Okay.
But let's say that I've got a line of handmade soaps. We'll go back to the example before. Mm-hmm. And I'm approached by an entrepreneur, maybe at one of the big annual shows or maybe at your show coming up in July, mm-hmm. and I meet another entrepreneur who's been doing a line of shampoos. And these are really just great, all-natural, great for your hair and your scalp, but I really just can't come up with a brand. And mm-hmm. so I approach you and I say, would you be willing to license me your brand? I'll follow certain quality control guidelines. I'll make sure that, you know, I don't put out a bad line of shampoos, but I'd like to trade under your brand.
Oh, so you would pay a fee for that.
Exactly. That would be known as a pure trademark-type license.
Oh.
Not involve a full-blown franchise, and that's the difference between the two.
Okay.
Just in case any of our listeners were confused between franchising and licensing. Licensing is
perfect.
Just a standalone license of some sort of singular body of intellectual property like your brand.
Perfect.
And franchising is where you're teaching them literally how to run an mm-hmm. entire business format. You're exercising controls over how they do it and why they do it and when they do it. Mm-hmm. All those issues are relevant.
That is a great way to describe it. That example was perfect. Now, what about a company that wants to hire sales reps and in, you know, 20 different cities? Is that licensing or franchising, or is that something else? Like if they have a little manual that describes the products and they can have home parties.
That's a great question. That's a little different. That's known as multi-level marketing.
Okay.
Or setting up distribution channels, and subject to certain laws, of course. There's nothing illegal with that. You could say, I think I'm going to distribute through home parties, and I'm going to have dealers, and those dealers can have dealers under them, and you just need to be aware of how does a multi-level marketing plan turn into what's known as an illegal pyramid, and
right.
make sure that you avoid structuring your company and distribution channels accordingly. But
right.
the point, the key point as we near the end of our show today
mm-hmm.
is to understand how these intellectual property assets, how to find them, how to identify them, can become drivers for business growth. That's really what we've been talking about in a nutshell.
Yeah, and with so many of our listeners really trying to figure out how they can maximize their brand name while starting to slowly minimize the physical labor that's involved in creating and selling the products that they have, and that's been very helpful for that. And I want to refer you guys to, well, first of all, you can learn more about Andrew Sherman at his website, growfastgrowright.com. That's growfastgrowright.com. The other thing you can do, because he's written so many books, is go to amazon.com and do a search on his name, and you'll come up with some. But I want to recommend the franchising and licensing book that he's written called Franchising and Licensing, Two Ways to Build Your Business. That's a wonderful resource for anybody who's looking to grow and expand a brand in other parts of the country when obviously you can't be there yourself. Andrew, thank you so much for helping us understand some of these issues. And as you've said throughout the show, we have barely touched the tip of the iceberg, but I feel good that we have given people some direction and sort of used some layperson's terms to describe some concepts that are very important for any business owner.
Well, you've got a great show, and your listeners are blessed to have you, and maybe we can arrange a future show to keep this conversation going.
Well, I will definitely be in touch with you about that. Thank you. I'm going to hold you to that. We have all these listeners out there who heard you say that. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time, and we will definitely be contacting you about that. You guys, I've got some great shows coming up for you on the horizon here this spring. Next week, we've got Leslie Morgan Steiner, an executive at the Washington Post and the author of the just-released book called Mommy Wars, Stay-at-Home and Career Moms Face Off on Their Choices, Their Lives, and Their Families. And as you guys know, I have some real thoughts about that issue, most especially the title of the book, which is a little bit controversial in my mind. And we're going to talk to Leslie about that and also about how choosing self-employment might be a good middle ground for parents everywhere. On May 22nd, we've got another author coming up who's written a book about moms exiting traditional workforce to be at home and be small business owners. And in between there, I'm sprinkling a lot of other useful things to help you break all the rules, build your own corporate ladder, and create the life you love. I'm so glad that you joined us today. This is the Lifestyle CEO Show. I'm your host, Donna Maria. Visit our website at lifestyleceo.com to take advantage of some of the free resources there. And I'll see you all next week.
You're listening to GlobalTalkRadio.com.